This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, y'all, real quick note, new order around here, no more live show, but I'm still going to be doing, basically along the Tom Woods model, just half-hour interviews every day for you, and maybe more than that, I don't know. But just stay tuned to scotthorton.org/interviews, sign up for the podcast feed, and that's where the majority of all the content is going to be from now, at least until the book is done. Okay? So, scotthorton.org/interviews. All right, now introducing our friend MJ Rosenberg. Long, long time ago, he was with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and boy, is he a critic now. Welcome back to the show, MJ. How are you doing?
Okay, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us again. And I'm reminded to put my ear goggles on here. And
okay.
I should say that I don't know. Do you have a place where you regularly write? If one searches your name, up comes The Nation and all kinds of other places
I know you've written in the past. I don't have a regular place. I'm a regular at Huffington Post.
At Huffington, right.
Yeah,
there's Huffington and The Nation. All kinds of stuff comes up.
A lot of
old great articles, even for Media Matters. And I know that sounds like a complete contradiction in terms to people. But, you know, one of my favorite articles, actually, about Israel that I've ever read was by you at Media Matters.
Really?
About how, yeah, we've talked about this numerous times, actually, now that I think about it. I hope. And that was, your article was, I think, starting from 1967 or maybe even before then. And you said, the peacenik said do this or else that'll happen. And then
right.
The Israeli war machine did the other thing instead, and the predicted terrible result took place. Then the peacenik said, okay, do this and not that or else the terrible thing will happen. And they did it again and again and again, and you
right.
gave, I don't know, 15 or 20-something examples over the last 30, 40, 50 years, something like that, of just – man, things really don't have to be this way. Things could really be much better over there if those with the military power would listen to those who don't want to use it.
Right. Of course, that also applies to the United States.
Absolutely. And to a much greater degree, even, really.
Yeah, it's not. It shouldn't be a surprise that they're like, that Israel's like our bosom buddy in the Middle East, because we both have the same mentality.
Right.
Always, you know, first resort is always to war or just, you know, just belligerency. And that's, yeah. So it's like, yeah, of course, nobody really can keep up with our record. We really win the prize on that one.
You know, it turns out just the other night, by chance, I was researching a little bit while I came upon the history of northwestern Travis County, where I live in the heart of Texas, you know, where the capital Austin is. And boy, do I feel like an Israeli settler. You know, the house I grew up in is right on land that was stolen from the Comanche with the brutalist of Nakbas. You know, I mean,
right,
that was their
right.
land. And
right.
and boy, and there is no denying how it was taken from them. There was no apologizing about it either. We are white civilization. They're savages. They're dead.
Yeah. And they eradicate basically what we in the United States did and what the Israelis are doing is they eradicate that there even was a historical presence of these people. I mean, in Israel right now, you know, there are signs, you know, in Hebrew, English, and Arabic. And on places where there were, like, Palestinian villages, they, you know, there would be signs that would say something that, you know, that was there. They're taking all those down. They don't want anyone to know what you just said about your home in Travis County. They don't want anyone to think that there were other people living here. When, in fact, the Hebrew names that are given for these places now are just variants of the Arabic names that were there for 800 years, you know, of these towns and villages. Now, we colonizers just like to eradicate, you know, because nobody wants any guilt, you know? No guilt. We've been here forever. We're the only ones that have been here.
Yeah. Yeah, if there ever were any Comanche around here, there must not have been very many of them per capita, per, you know, by the mile or whatever it was. And some kind of rationalizations start creeping in. And,
I know. It's amazing. But, you know, I think this has been going on since the Roman Empire.
Right. Well, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, being raised in Travis County my whole life. Like, of course, we learned about the Indians and everything, but it was like learning about ancient history. It was, and it's true, was, you know, it had been 150 years, but that's not 1500 or, you know what I mean?
Right.
That's pretty recent. Anyway.
Yeah, right.
All right. So listen, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee is in town. In Washington, D.C., holding their annual convention. Very interesting politics this time around, especially after the Iran deal and the presidential election year with Donald Trump, the wild card in there, and everything else. So I'm not even sure, I guess, you know, what to ask you first other than, you know, what did you think of Hillary Clinton's speech this morning? And I guess we'll, you know, can follow up from there.
Well, started with Vice President Biden last night, and he, you know, he, something about Biden, he gives this, he's so effusive in this, like, nauseatingly cloying way, he personalized it so much. You know, he loves Israel, he's always loved Israel, he tells stories about what Golda Meir told him in 1972 or whatever it was, what really, and this may sound weird, but I was really offended by the fact that he brought up his late son, Bo Biden, and talked about how much Bo Biden loved Israel and how he took Bo Biden's children to Israel and how important that is. And I thought, gee, you know, if God forbid I ever lost a kid, it would be hard enough to get up in the morning. And we know it is that hard for Biden. We know that. But yet, the last thing you'd want to do is invoke the kid's name for political, you know, for to pander. And it was just like, wow, politicians are not normal.
Yeah, it's pretty
ugly. I mean, you know, normal people, when they've had a tragedy, it's like you don't bring it up casually. People, you know, they bring it up very carefully. I mean, you talking to them, don't bring it up at all. And you wait. But he just, like, threw it out there. And Bo loved Israel. Jeez. So, you know, just like nothing, and this is the APAC effect, you know, this, you know, giving this nauseating pandering. The only good thing about it was that he said stuff about settlements, against settlements that they didn't like, and there was lots of booing. So, you know, when you're talking about the context of an APAC conference, the more booing there is, the more that indicates that something good has been said. And then Hillary today, she just gave a standard APAC speech. It was basically the same speech Obama would give, rather than being a speech that, let's say, a Republican would give. Or it was just like standard. She punched all, you know, she said all the stuff. She said that she's going to do, have negotiations. But then she said the United States must never be neutral. So I guess she's going to convene negotiations, but as Israel's advocate. So who's going to go to those negotiations? I mean, you know, my expectations for APAC are so low, and for the people who speak there, that I didn't think Hillary's speech was that bad, because I judge it against the standards of, that Chuck Schumer would give, or even Biden would give. It was just standard. But,
I think that really is saying something, because, man, was it a hawkish speech.
Oh, yeah,
If that's moderate, then God dang, man, you know?
That's moderate for APAC. I mean, let's see. Maybe, you know, I think they're having Bob Menendez.
Well, look, wouldn't it be fair to say that she is, you know, outright to the right of Obama on everything?
Everything related to Israel, you mean?
Yeah, or even all foreign policy. I mean, if we're talking about Syria, we're still talking about Israel too, aren't we? You know?
Yeah, well, that's true. The one thing that she made clear that she's to the right of Obama was when she said that among the first things she will do was invite Netanyahu to the White House. Mm-hmm. Well, she knows very well the whole point of that, and the reason that the APAC crowd went crazy cheering is Obama. Ever since, you know, Netanyahu did that business of coming to the Congress and, you know, not even telling him, Netanyahu has not, he's been persona non grata in Washington, and she's like saying, well, unlike Obama, I'm going to treat him like the friend he is. So, yeah, she's definitely to the right of Obama. Though, the thing is that the hope I have for her, if she becomes president, is that, I mean, it's a thing to a straw, but she hates Obama. She hates Netanyahu. And she's not she's really just faking being a right winger. But, you know, what difference does that make? You know, it doesn't matter what's in people's hearts. It's a matter of what's in their policy. So we'll have to see. I have so little hope for this issue and that the United States can do anything good about this issue at all. I really do. That's why I support the BDS movement and, you know, just people, you know, doing what we can, because our government is just so locked into being in lockstep with the Israelis.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, it's almost like, you know, and who would be the candidate? You know, Sanders didn't speak, which is good. I'm glad he didn't speak, but I'm not sure his speech would have been all that different. I mean, during the Gaza war, whenever that was, 2 years ago or whatever, I mean, he was screaming and yelling at constituents who were telling him to condemn, you know, the slaughter that Israel was, doing in Gaza. And he was getting really indignant and really defensive. So the thing is, Israel and the money that Israel brings to their campaigns drives all these people crazy. It's like they're bitten. It's like they become rabid, but it's not out of conviction. It's for the money.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, and I so in other words, but here's the interesting thing. The interesting thing is tonight at 5:00, Donald Trump is speaking. Now, he's a loose cannon. We don't know what he's going to say. He could try to out-pander Hillary, which is hard, but he could do it. But he's such a contrary kind of guy that he might get up there and tell AIPAC what it doesn't want to hear. I mean, he's tried it a few times in which he said that he wants the United States to be neutral. Maybe he is going to, I mean, it's just...
The problem is he doesn't know anything about it, right? So
he can't
read him the Riot Act on, like, listen, your settlements in Area C are standing over the way of whatever settlement over
B. He doesn't know anything. Yeah. And one of the things I noticed with him, he was on one of the shows, and instead of saying Israelis, he says Jews. I mean... How primitive can you get? I mean, really? We're talking about, the Jewish people, and they're
Well, it just goes to show he's not even used to discussing the issue at all.
No,
you know,
exactly.
Yeah. He doesn't mean anything negative by it. He's just he's just approaching it as with brand new virgin eyes, basically.
Well,
somebody owns some land, is in some dispute or something, what?
Yeah.
You know?
But the other thing, he's such a petty and personal, you know, he's oriented always by his feelings. He might say some decent things at AIPAC, decent from our point of view, because there was some Jewish businessman in New York he's mad at. You know? He's just
maybe. I mean, I think people are counting on that, and I've actually heard people saying that about Hillary too, that they trust that she is such a Richard Nixon son of a bitch that it's going to be really hard for Netanyahu to push her around, frankly, or anybody else, that she'll be able to say, like, hey, here's a line and you can't cross it. Now, I'm not saying I endorse that view, but that's the only hope that people have, is that you would have an executive who's a loose cannon enough that they can't really be corralled. And after all, you know, after they tried to push the Israel lobby, AIPAC especially, tried to push us into war with Syria in 2013.
Right.
And after they worked with Netanyahu to try to ruin the Iran nuclear deal, which is working spectacularly so far,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. Like, they're pretty far out on a limb, far more than they used to be. You know, that whole thing about the Nightflower lobby that regular Americans don't know about, those days are pretty much coming to an end, I think.
No, I agree. I think the Americans American people are aware of it. It's an interesting, the thing about Trump, the Anti-Defamation League and the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, which is another one of those anti-discrimination Jewish organizations, they're both calling on people to walk out of Trump's speech at AIPAC. It has nothing to do with Israel. It has to do with the bigotry and, you know, all that. So, it could be really interesting tonight. AIPAC, anyway, I used to work there, so I know all they want is everyone to be really polite to everyone. I mean, if Joseph Goebbels spoke, they would tell all the people, hey, be cool. We're bipartisan. So I'm kind of what I most hope for. I'm hoping against hope that the Trump speech becomes totally wild tonight, that he says things like, you know, we have to be neutral, and the people start screaming, and they feel self-righteous because you know, Trump's the racist guy and the anti-immigration guy, but they don't care about that. All they really care about is Israel. But they'll look like they're on the side of the angels if they're all shaking their fists at Trump. I don't know. It's hard to say. What sickens
me. If I had to bet, I'd have to say he's going to get up there and kiss their ass. Come on.
All right, that's what I think, too. Because you know what?
He's a businessman. He knows.
Yeah.
You know, this is why they said in that New York Times piece that the establishment, they all hate Cruz more than they fear Trump. Because after all, this is a guy who all his worst, most blustery, most racist, whatever stuff, he doesn't mean any of that. At the end of the day, he'll come right to the table and shake hands like everybody else. They trust his business sense, you know, ultimately.
You know, I think that's probably true. But can we hope? I mean, I would just love a wild scene there with people screaming because he dares to say. I mean, the thing is, it's so nuts. First of all, the thing that's most nuts of all is that any presidential candidate speak at a lobby that is openly dedicated to the interests of a foreign country.
Right.
It is insane.
That we're even having this conversation at all right now.
Pardon?
That we're even having this conversation at all today. Yeah,
it's crazy. I mean, look, let's say that, you know, there are lots and lots of Indian Americans in this country and you know, Chinese Americans, all kinds of, you know, Americans from different places. But presidential candidates, the sole point of, and also the sole point of going to this foreign lobby is to say things that will lock you into a policy supporting a foreign country. That's the purpose of it. That's what you're going there for. To get those standing ovations, you have to say that you're going to put Israel's interests above the United States. Because obviously that's what they did on the Iran deal. There's obviously, their president of the United States says this deal is in our interest. They're saying it's not in Israel's interest, so we're against it. So you're talking about a foreign lobby, and they're all going there. I mean, Ted Cruz, I thought he's some big patriot. What's he doing there? It's just like when it comes to Israel, everything's like flipped. You know, it's just, you know, I think I've talked to, you know, mentioned on your show before that before World War II, when England was desperate to get the United States into a war, you know, for good reasons, but that's not the point. They did not go and organize in Washington, you know, and have gigantic conventions where people could, you know, demand that, you know, Roosevelt go to war when Roosevelt wasn't ready to go to war. That would have been unheard of. And that would, I mean, it's just, you don't do that. Foreign countries here don't do that. What they do is they hire lobby. You know, they hire a law firm, and they have a couple of lobbyists who are maybe, or they can have 20 lobbyists who are working on their interests, but they're registered under the foreign, you know, the, you know, foreign registration, what's it called? The foreign, FARA, foreign, you know, the thing that lobbyists have to be registered. And AIPAC's not even a registered lobby. They can do whatever they want, then they get directly involved in politics and support the candidates that support Israel.
Yeah.
Only in America, as they say.
Yep. Well, and you know, it's funny too, like you say also about how flipped around it is. That means there's a real opening there for anyone, and I don't have any faith in Trump or anybody else doing it. Anybody on the national political scene right now at all. But the opening is there for someone to tell the simple truth. And
right.
Even if it's, you know, completely, you know, based on Zionist principles that you're damn right America's going to protect Israel forever and ever and ever,
right.
But within 67 borders, pal.
Right, exactly.
You know, if someone was willing to get up there and say, like, I demand that all the cable news channels show the people of America a map and explain
right.
that Palestinians live on the West Bank. They live in the Gaza
right.
Strip. That ain't Israel.
Right.
That's their land. And, you know, I mean, it's a simple thing. It's 2 + 2 = 4. There's no way, you know, the way Hillary Clinton spoke, oh, yeah, the terrorist armies with their knives coming and attacking Israelis, and she can narrow in on specific individual civilians who were murdered, but the entire pretext or premise is somehow that you know, these terrorists are coming from the outside and invading Israel when they're attacking, at least in great majorities, they're attacking people in occupied territory.
Right. And, you know, listening to Hillary's speech, you wouldn't know that there was such a thing as occupied territories.
Right.
You wouldn't know there's such a thing as good Palestinians who are not, quote, terrorists. You know, every reference she had to Palestinians was about terrorists. Nothing about the occupation. Nothing, you know, didn't discuss anything about feeling any compassion or empathy for the Palestinians. I mean, that was
you think the knife attackers were swimming across the Jordan River to sneak into Israel and invade it and stab people.
Right, right. But, you know, when you talk about, I think one of the indicators that we can expect nothing good from American politicians on this was Rand Paul. Because I thought that he's Ron Paul's son, and he himself has had expressed in the past a lot of skepticism about America's neoconservative foreign policy. I thought that was the root, he could have distinguished himself in those debates by taking those kind of positions and maybe a kind of isolationist in a good way position. He didn't. He gave us the same kind of pro-Israel bombast as the rest of them. It was just like, there's too much money at stake.
Yeah.
He also thought somehow that he could trick Sheldon Adelson into supporting him, Like, I'm not going to offend that guy.
Well, what it was? It wasn't quite that. What I think happened was Sheldon Adelson had leaked that he was going to run a Stop Rand campaign. And then Rand went and kissed his ring and made a deal.
Geez.
And I don't know the exact specifics, but I know he came out against the Iran deal and he came out for independent Kurdistan almost immediately after meeting with Sheldon Adelson.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
So I don't think the deal was that Adelson would pay him, but that at least cease fire, man. Trust me, Rand said, I'm no threat.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so that was the deal that they made, was that Adelson wouldn't run a Get Rand campaign. So it wasn't even for the money. It was just for not spending the money against him.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, though, is that, with the Republicans, you have, any politician has to, deal with the fact that their base is crazy right wing on Israel because of the evangelicals and others, but between the evangelicals and the neocons, their base is really Benjamin Netanyahu's base. Democratic Party is changing. I mean, I'm hoping. I wrote a piece about that in the Huffington Post. I mean, I hope Hillary looks at those polls. The Bernie Sanders people and the young Democrats and Democrats in general. The Pew poll shows that Democrats people who identify as Democrats are as pro-Israel as they are pro-Palestinian. It's the same numbers, like they're both in the 40s. Sympathy for both. Totally different than the Republicans. The generation coming up, and this includes Jews, but not, includes everybody, is not enamored of Israel anymore. Those days are over. And if they are enamored of Israel, they're enamored of an Israel that would make sacrifices for peace. Make an offer the way Rabin did, reach out, not just be a brutal fist in their face like, they are now. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I think that one of the reasons that Hillary's speech was not, in my opinion, as bad as it could have been, is that she's keeping one eye on those Sanders kids. She thinks that, those kids on campus, people who are young people for Bernie, they're not going to go for that Biden. I go crazy over Biden's phrase. He always says there must be no daylight between Israeli policies and U.S. policies. She didn't say anything that nauseating, and I think it's interesting, though, that I think we're going to see Sanders might be changing things, not specifically on this issue, but in general, for people to become more aware of what the Democratic base is. And it's much further left than people like Hillary Clinton are used to.
Yeah, it's so much further left than him on foreign policy issues, too. And it's a real shame that he – and you know what? Any of these hypocrites, they can flip-flop. And that was funny. I meant to say politicians. Any of these politicians Everybody knows they're all hypocrites, and they can flip-flop around and whatever. And Bernie Sanders has been pretty bad on, you know, Bill Clinton's bombing of Iraq and sanctions blockade in the 90s. And he was good on Iraq War II, but he was bad on funding it and bad on Libya and bad on some things. But nobody holds a candle to Hillary Clinton, certainly not in the Democratic Party. I mean, she's Dick Cheney. So even if she tried to hit back at Sanders with, yeah, but you sort of kind of supported that too, it could never, you know, it would always pale in comparison to her hawkish advocacy of all of these wars, at least since Kosovo, you know, at the top of her lungs and including the Afghan surge and everything. But he just won't attack her on foreign policy at all. And he could have her ass. I mean, come on. She's blew up Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen. Boy, she completely destroyed Yemen with her coup d'etat, putting Hadi in there, and led straight to the current war, you know.
But I wouldn't give up on him yet on this, because he says he told AIPAC or something about it. When he turned down the AIPAC speech, he said he's going to be giving a foreign policy speech really soon. So I'm not, I mean, true, he has never said much of anything about foreign policy, but unlike Hillary, he's not particularly interested in foreign policy. I mean, he has to learn this stuff. And, I don't know. He's run such a good campaign in terms of doing so much better than anyone thought. I think it's possible that we could be surprised if in the next stage he doesn't go after Hillary on foreign policy. We know he's not a neocon. At most, what he is kind of like, that's not my issue. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
The other way, I think one of the things I don't like about Bernie Sanders is that he has these things like you're not allowed to question him on it. Did you watch the videos, you know, the video of him, you know, when those anti-Gaza people, you know, when he was talking to them? He just tried, like, he doesn't seem interested in broadening himself. Like, you know, okay, I know he doesn't know much about the Middle East. Well, damn it, you're running for president, learn.
Well, and he lived over there for a while, right? So it's not like he's completely, you know, doesn't understand the security situation or whatever it is.
I don't know
whose land is whose on the West Bank, you know.
His heart is totally domestic issues. I don't blame him. I mean, I can understand that. I mean, that's who he is, you know.
Political reasons, you know, I mean, why? If you look at how far left he is on this, that, or the other issue, somebody who agrees with him on all those issues would tend to be much better on foreign policy.
Yes, so you think
his default is to be pretty middle of the road and, i.e., bad, you know, on foreign policy. But you're right, he never made it a centerpiece, but he's smart enough politically to be horrible. But, see, I think what's going on here is he's trying to pull Hillary to the left on domestic issues a bit, and he's trying to keep the left inside the Democratic Party until Endorse Hillary Day comes. And he knows that that's his role here, is to deliver his voters to her. And he doesn't want to weaken and undermine her too bad because, hey, anybody but Trump, right, and all that. So he's not
going for
the jugular where he absolutely could destroy her. I mean, just on the Libya war, he could just explain in four sentences why this is the least qualified person in the world to be in charge of our military, you know?
Right. You know, it's funny. You can look at it all different ways. I'm kind of, you know, I'm Jewish, so to me it's kind of cool that we have a Jewish guy, the first, you know, Jewish guy ever to, you know, seriously run for president. Joe Lieberman didn't count. He didn't win anything. And he's not a crazy Zionist. I mean,
that was cool that all the Muslims in Michigan all came out and voted for him, too.
Yes, right. I mean, he really is a bridge between, you know, between Muslims and Jews. It's amazing. Joe Lieberman was, you know, he was the first, you know, Jewish national figure, you know, Jewish figure to really make it on the national scene. And he was a rabid Zionist. This guy, Bernie Sanders is the old school. He represents the old fashioned liberal Jews before they were totally blinded by ethnic chauvinism. He has no use for ethnic chauvinism. And I really admire him for that. I really do.
Yeah,
it's nervy, but it certainly makes him unpopular at AIPAC, no matter what he says. You know, he could have got up there and said, "I love Israel, I love Israel," but they look at him and they say, "Ah, you don't really. You're some kind of you're like an American."
Well, he gave a really good speech about Islamophobia in Michigan and completely denounced it.
Oh, I didn't know that. Really?
I don't know exactly how great it was. I read it. I didn't read of it. And, you know, some quotes out of it and stuff. I didn't watch the video, but, you know, he was basically saying, like, hey, hey, this is very first principle American values here. That we're all Thomas Jefferson on this issue. I don't care what God you're interested in. Stop. You know?
No, I think that's really, it's old-fashioned. Within the context of the Jewish community, he's an old-fashioned socialist Jew from the 1930s. He's not that generation, really. He's the next generation. But it's heartening. And, you know, I also love the fact he doesn't give, you know, he doesn't put out all this religion BS at all. I mean, for him to get this, you'd never get that guy to say, God bless America. Well, maybe, you know, that would really be the test. When Bernie Sanders starts ending speeches with God bless America, we know we'd lost him. But up to this point, he doesn't do any of that pandering on that, you know, that everybody does. Hillary talks about her growing up in Methodist church, and everybody, you know, talks about their religion. He doesn't do that. I got to give him credit. He's not—he's far from perfect, and I would definitely prefer, you know, I prefer Elizabeth Warren, frankly, as a, you know, but he's done pretty good. And
I think he would be a lot stronger candidate against Trump, too. This is the thing. I think he would be a much stronger candidate against Trump.
Because of the appealing to, like, you know, the grievances on economic issues and that kind of stuff, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, he basically sounds like a nicer version of Trump when it comes to, oh, the Mexicans and the Chinese are taking all our jobs away, which I think is economic ignorance. But anyway, everybody apparently loves hearing that kind of thing. But he obviously has some idea what he's talking about.
Right.
And I think in the contrast, there was one night, I forget if it was Super Tuesday or which it was, but there was one night where he gave a speech and then they clipped over to Trump. And from substance to bluster was just such a night and day kind of thing. I disagree with Sanders. I mean, I'm a libertarian individualist, pro-capitalist, you know, in every way. I disagree with him on all this stuff. But just the fact that, like, here's a guy who is interested in reading books about stuff versus here's a guy who believes in himself a lot or whatever, you know what I mean? It's pretty clear. And here's the other thing. Is she is so personally scandalous. If she does not run on, that's right, I'm Richard Nixon, baby, and what this empire needs is a mean SOB to take charge of this thing. If she doesn't run on that and tries to pretend that that's not who she is and run away from that, he's just going to destroy her. That's the only advantage that she has, and it's a real weakness. The only only thing she can do is try to turn it into an advantage, but I don't think she can. And so it's not just that she's bad on every single policy issue in the whole wide world, but and even championed the most horrible of the policies, especially on the wars. But she also has, I always thought it was 45. It's a 55% disapproval rating of people who they just don't trust her. And why? Because they know if they were a Saudi prince that they could pay her a foundation a few hundred thousand dollars and then run away with some F-16s or whatever it is. I mean, they know that she is so corrupt. And I think she just reminds people of their boss that they hate. She's just a really lousy candidate in terms of substance and image. You know?
But she's going to be running against someone who scares the hell out of everybody.
Well, that's true. But you know what? Look at Romney and Obama 2012. It was the country's pretty evenly split as far as it goes. And yet some people love Obama. As much as people hated Obama, some people loved him. Right?
Well,
nobody
true.
Loved Romney. And that was the margin. That was the margin, was the love. And so Romney, people were willing to vote against Obama, but was anybody really coming out for Romney? No. And that's what Hillary Clinton is doing. She's running on settle for me. Whereas Trump has people who are absolutely in thrall, you know?
Yeah, but people like me, quote unquote, liberals, progressive, whatever, I know so many people who absolutely can't stand Hillary Clinton, but are so, the hate for, and I use the word hated, but I mean hate. The hate for Donald Trump will cause them to go down to purple states and campaign for her just because of that race baiting that he does.
Yeah, I can see that. He really has pushed that part beyond what was smart even for his tactics.
And that's going to, because there's a point, because in the early stages, it's what put him on the map. It's how he won. But he keeps doing it. That and the woman stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, like, geez. I mean, how many more times are you going to keep offending women with these stupid attacks on Megyn Kelly? I mean, he seems like, you know, you start talking about Hillary being like a boss you can't stand. Trump and his buddy in New Jersey, who he hangs out with now, Christie, they're like the kind of people that make women want to throw up. I mean, you know, they're, you know, just vicious misogynists. I mean,
well, and they remind everybody of Tony Soprano and the Boys too. With that
that too.
This guy reminds us of a mob boss more than a senator or a president.
You know,
in a lot of ways.
We really live in great times. Great times.
Absolutely.
Great choices we have here. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing of it is, I mean, it was going to be Jeb, right? Trump is completely the black swan here. It was going to be Mr. Centrist, Rhino, liberal Republican versus the conservative Democrat. Might as well be the Rockefellers themselves up there, same as always or whatever.
Right.
But here's a guy who is rich enough. He's the only guy in our whole society that I could think of who's rich enough, famous enough, and full of himself enough to kick down the door and just say, no, me instead.
Right.
I mean, otherwise you have to be a governor or a senator, period. That's just how the system works, you know?
That's interesting, though, because what you're saying, he is the only person who could do it. Yeah. That's true. That makes it either good news or bad news, in my opinion, bad news.
Yeah,
but
me too.
A singular, personality. Right. If Donald Trump, you know, fell over and died today, you can't find another one. Say, okay, I'm going to take his place. Who would take his place? Kanye? I mean, you know, are we putting up like celebrities? Well, who has that kind of money? Nobody.
Right.
That's the other thing. The idea that of increasing the pool that we choose presidents from being governors and senators and adding ridiculous TV personalities to the pool, rich TV. I mean, we're just going downhill.
Yeah.
And
it's for good or for ill. That's the thing of it. You know what I mean? It's all this technology is a double-edged sword. So on one hand, local police murders of unarmed civilians become national news stories because social media insists and makes it that way, and TV has to give in to that.
Right.
And we also run Trump for president.
That's right.
So, you know, it's things are changing for good and for bad.
No, that's true. But that's the thing about technology. I mean, it's just like you just don't know how it's going to play out.
Right.
I would say all in all, it's probably for the good, for the first reason that you also local repression, local violence, local, you hear about them now. But then there's the Kardashians.
Yep.
Hey, they're the next ones to run.
There always was, though. I mean, whoever came before them, you always have that kind of celebrity.
Oh, yeah, well, name who did come before them? I don't remember anybody before them.
Oh, I don't know. Well, actually, I've never seen that show, so I don't really know anything except the name and boobs. But
I couldn't pick her out in the lineup. But
everyone being all very, very concerned with the personal lives of famous people.
Yes.
I mean, that ain't new.
No, definitely. And it is, I mean, that's the bread and circuses thing. That's the distraction. You know, everybody's into, movie stars and sports figures, and it's a gigantic distraction from what's going on in society.
Hey, you know what? We're way over here, but to get back to, well, I don't care. I mean, that's the whole thing is it's all pre-recorded and people can listen as long as they want or not or what. I don't care. I want to get back to the Israel thing again, though. I mean, this is all very relevant, the domestic politics, the presidential election and everything. But there was something you said earlier that, and I'm not sure if you mentioned this exact poll. I think you may have been referring to this same poll that I saw that I think was at Phil Weiss's blog. Where they had, it was a poll of Jewish students, American Jewish students.
Yeah.
And all the numbers on support for Israel were really low. And I'm not sure who came up with the poll, but the questions were along the lines of, do you consider Israel to be part of Western civilization or not? And this kind of thing. And the numbers were down in the 30%.
Way low. Right.
For support. And so what that meant to me was, I mean, I guess a couple of important things. First of all, American Jews, as we've discussed numerous times, as you've been explaining yourself, are liberals and believe in civil rights stuff and don't cotton to Jim Crow, whether it's here or whether it's there. But the other part of that is they actually know a thing or two about it because they're American Jews, presumably. I mean, and I don't know how much information – you know, they're raised with or whatever. But my assumption is they know more than the average American about what's going on over there and who's occupying who. And that's why they are, even more than the civil rights principles, just the fact that they know what's going on over there, even in the broadest strokes, makes them the first ones to turn against the project. Where the average American idiot who believes Hillary Clinton that the knife attackers are coming from across the river somewhere or whatever would tend to still be in Israel's camp.
Yeah, you know, that is really good analysis. I agree. American Jews, it's very hard to grow up Jewish in this country and not know about Israel. So you know about it, you know, if you're at all, you know, have a brain, you look into it for yourself. The brain dead ones become the AIPAC youths, you know, and they go to the AIPAC conference and they, you know, but most of them are on the left politically, and then they say, wait a minute, what is this occupation thing? I think you're absolutely right. Comparing the average non-Jewish young person and the average Jewish young person, it's the Jewish kids who know about the occupation and don't like it. I think that's why they're very, you know, they're very active on campus, Jewish kids with like the boycott movement and other things. Yeah. It's changing. It's just changing.
Yep.
I feel that, I mean, I'm not confident. Time is not on the side of this project. That's for sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I'll let you go. I want to make sure this thing is not overly long so people will still listen to it.
Okay, well, listen.
But I've had a great time talking with you again. It's been way too long.
Yeah, me too. Okay, see ya.
All right, good times. Have a good one.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, y'all, that is the great MJ Rosenberg. Once upon a time, back in the 80s, maybe early 90s, a long time ago, he worked at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, so he's got a real insight on how they operate. And you can check out his website at mjrosenberg.net, the letters MJ, and rosenberg.net, and read him at the Huffington Post as well. And thanks. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.